Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Last week, a jury in Minneapolis convicted a police officer for the death of George Floyd, holding the officer accountable for an act of police brutality that sparked protests across the country and around the world. George Floyd's murder reignited the debate about Confederate monuments, which are one of the focal points in the struggle for racial justice. Remarkably, these Confederate monuments are still up more than 150 years after the Civil War. Why were these monuments installed? Why are they still there? And what will it take to remove them from our public spaces? Our guest today, Dr. Karen Cox, just wrote the book on Confederate monuments. The book is called No Common Ground: Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Dr. Cox is an award-winning historian and professor of history at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. She has published two other books about the South, including Dixie's Daughters, the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Preservation of the Confederate Culture. She regularly gives media interviews on Southern history and culture. Dr. Karen Cox, welcome to All Together Now.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
I love your book, and I appreciate you writing it, so thank you for that. I'm wondering, you began research around these Confederate monuments beginning like three decades ago. What inspired you to get going to look into the issue of the Confederate monuments?
Well, it really was the United Daughters of the Confederacy that I kind of fell down a rabbit hole researching, they're the group of white women, middle and upper class white women, who were most responsible for the vast majority of Confederate monuments that are on the Southern landscape, and so. But it began, while I was working for a museum in North Carolina. I interviewed some members of the UDC who had been in the organization since they were in the Children of the Confederacy. So it was just, it's just something that, you know, kind of ebbs and flows with me, but it's been flowing a lot since 2015.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, here we are three decades later after you began your research, and you wrote that you were sick of talking about the damn monuments. So what encouraged you to circle back and write this book and re-engage in this debate?
Well, I had been writing publicly about Confederate monuments and Confederate memorialization, and trying to demonstrate the link between these statues and current events. And I've been doing that since the Charleston Massacre of 2015, but I was kind of tired of talking about them. That's not a joke. There were a couple of instances where I was presenting to audiences that were interracial, that were in the South, that were both interracial and also people of faith. And this was interesting because this is a brand new audience for me. And I was inspired. I thought, you know, clearly these communities are grappling with this issue, and they could really use some guidance, and they could use some historical context around this issue. And so that was what inspired me to do it. And I thought I would just be mired in the early, you know, Jim Crow period when they were built. But this book takes everything from the end of the Civil War to up to the protest of last summer.
It's a very timely book. And, you know, sometimes as a researcher, you never know when what you're studying is going to like flare up to the front page again. And there you were with this great knowledge. And I honestly, when I found out about these Confederate statues, I was shocked. I was like, why are they even still standing? And how did they get them up? You know, because obviously they were tributes to these Confederate soldiers and generals, and it had to have an after the Civil War, but these guys were traitors. They were trying to secede from the United States of America and set up their own country. And that even one of these monuments was allowed up is shocking to me. But tell us, how did that happen that these statues got to be here?
Well, you know, that's a long history, and it begins almost immediately after the Civil War. And it begins with the creation of a narrative called The Lost Cause. Mm-hmm. There was a book that came out in 1866, which was a history of the Civil War, called The Lost Cause, that was written by a man named Edward Pollard, who was a Richmond journalist. And he sort of lays a blueprint out and says, you know, the only thing that was decided here was military defeat and the end of slavery. That's it. Nothing else has been decided. And at that point, he said, and that included, in the language of the day, Negro equality, of course, you know, or the vote. And so obviously the 15th Amendment gave Black men the right to vote a few years later, but it was that narrative and then the myths. It was basically there was revisionism happening almost immediately about why the South had seceded, what they were, you know, what was the purpose of all of this. And they always said, well, it was never about slavery. And it was clear that it was about slavery, and it was about states' rights. And the, you know, we have superior, you know, fighting men, but, you know, they just outmanned us, and, you know, the North, you know, outmanned us and outgunned us, you know, they had more war materiel. So it's that narrative in the context of this narrative, which, you know, says this was a just cause, not just a lost cause, but a just one. It's in that context that you begin seeing, well, first of all, you begin seeing monuments built immediately in Confederate cemeteries. Mm-hmm. But then they begin to move outside of into more public spaces along boulevards. And then when the United Daughters of the Confederacy emerges in, and this has always been a women's project. And when there's a second generation of women have joined in and formed the United Daughters of the Confederacy, then they take this to a completely different level. And this is where the hundreds of monuments that end up on mostly on courthouse lawns or at the state capitals, that's when most of these are built. And it's because of these women. And, you know, when they were organized in 1894, this was a period across the South when state legislatures are dialing back the progress of Reconstruction, eliminating the right to vote for Black men. And it's also a very racially violent decade, the 1890s, mm-hmm. an epidemic of lynching. And it's just sort of that trying to eliminate Black men from public spaces and from the political sphere opened the door for these women in some ways to emerge as public figures, but all in, you know, on behalf of Confederate memorialization. So they really, you know, were just handed the keys almost, so to speak, to do whatever it is that they wanted to do.
Right. And it's distressing to me that it was the women taking the lead on these monuments. But, you know, from their point of view, they were honoring their dead heroes, the men who went to battle when they couldn't go to battle, but they could honor their dead with the statues. So I kind of see that element. But this got taken to a whole other level. And you talk in the book that the Southern Poverty Law Center has documented over 1,700 monuments, markers, and memories of the Confederates. And about 800 of those are statues. And we're not talking like little remembrances. I mean, some of these are gigantic memorials. So
some of them are, you know, rise up 30 and 40 and beyond feet in the air. And I think it's also important for people to understand, you know, that it wasn't just that they were honoring their ancestors. They were really had their eye on the future. The UDC did. This is why they formed a group called the Children of the Confederacy. They involved children in the monument rituals. It was really about you know, perpetuating these ideas onto future generations of white Southerners, and they were highly successful.
And when you say perpetuate ideas, you mean talk about perpetuate the idea of white supremacy and that whites should be in charge and blacks are should be like second class citizens, if at all. And and I, you know, I see what you're saying, that there was this big spate of the monuments built in the, you know, 1890 to 1920 seems to be the big when hundreds of these were erected. But what also disturbed me was it's almost like every decade they kept building more. It's like that wasn't enough. It wasn't like, oh, here's our honored dead from the Civil War. Now let's move on. There was this systematic, concerted effort to keep putting these monuments up and keep doing ceremonies and Confederate Memorial Days to keep this whole myth about the South and its state rights and white supremacy, to keep that whole myth alive.
Yeah, that's true. So in every decade since the Civil War, there have been new Confederate monuments built, including the last decade. There have been 35 new monuments since 2000. And you're right. So the vast majority were built by World War I. Things slowed down quite a bit after that, but they were still building them. And so what you see, though, is the ritualizing of the monuments on an annual basis through Confederate Memorial Day, or those are big community events. You know, you go down to the local monument. There's a speaker that day. The children are involved in these ceremonies, and so it becomes part of this, you know, not only this myth that the South does, but community-wise, at the community level, that this is occurring, and doing that on a regular basis, and having these statues stand on the grounds of courthouses signals to the local Black community that they're second-class citizens. And who's in charge here, right? White men.
Right. And, you know, you think about the Blacks who are moving, they need to have some business in the courthouse or some business in the state legislature. They're walking by like these, you know, 50-foot statues of Robert E. Lee or whatever Confederate general. And it was a real statement of like, you don't belong here and the whites are in charge. And it's that intimidate, and that these were sites not only of these annual Confederate Memorial Days, but also lynchings. And, you know, it was like a very conscious effort to intimidate Blacks so they would not stick their heads up and register to vote or cause any trouble, or they'd be killed.
Yeah, so, you know, it's very much attached to, you know, any kind of Black progress is kind of smack it down, you know. So there's progress. There was progress in the, you know, since the Civil War, and that's why, you know, and then there's pushback about on that, and these symbols become significant again. So, you know, during the era of civil rights, for example, the battle flag reemerges as a defiant symbol, the Confederate battle flag. In 2015, following the Charleston massacre and the Confederate battle flag was removed from the grounds of the state capitol in South Carolina, the monument never went anywhere. But what's interesting about it is you see photographs of protesters. Where are they protesting? At the base of the Confederate monument. They're, you know, so the monuments seem, on the one hand, seem static, but they're being used in different ways at different inflection points in the racial history of the South.
Right. And obviously the monuments have very different meanings. You know, to the South, Southern whites, they're claiming this is our Southern heritage. Mm-hmm. And the subtext of white supremacy. And to the Blacks, it's like, this is slavery and this is the racism and this is white nationalism. And we're taking a stand against that.
Right. So, you know, one of the reasons I recall the book, No Common Ground, is there's no common ground in the ways in which different groups of people perceive what these monuments mean. Black Southerners have always criticized these monuments. They've always said, and they were some of the first to say, why are we building monuments to traitors to the United States? Right. They took up arms against the U.S., and said, you know, they wanted these things removed. You know, the Chicago Defender did a question and says, you know, should there be a federal law abolishing these statues? Mm-hmm. And there was a resounding yes. And these people are, one person wrote in, you know, to honor these skunks, you know, for their traitorous behavior is just, you know, is an insult. It's an insult to Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses Grant.
Absolutely right. And that was absolutely my first response when I heard about these monuments. I was like, why are we putting up monuments to traitors?
They did a great job. And here's the thing, you know, white Northerners just turned a blind eye. They didn't, you know, they held their nose or whatever they might have done, because they were eager to reestablish an economic relationship with the white South. They began, you know, there's some historical amnesia on the part of Northern veterans within a few decades after the war ends.
Right. And I would imagine, I mean, you're the historian here, but I am from the North. I would imagine if you were in the North after the Civil War, you would probably think, okay, we won. Let's be the gracious victor. We want to heal. And there's some obviously very raw feelings about the whole thing, but the war will recede and the next generation will come up and they'll know that Blacks have the right to vote and we're all one United States of America again. And so that was wishful thinking. And maybe that mindset played into turning that blind eye you talked about and just letting the Southerners do what they wanted down there.
Well, there is that. And there's also the fact that, you know, to be quite honest, in popular culture, you know, Black stereotypes played really well with audiences all across the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in the 1880s and 1890s, they, you know, all those producing quote unquote coon songs that were being published and written by Northerners, white Northerners. So, and that shows up in films as well, you know, Birth of a Nation all the way to Gone with the Wind. This is something that, white Northerners buy into that romance a little bit.
Well, and some of them buy into the white supremacy or
racism.
As
well. Yeah. And so obviously this has changed over time. You know, yes, these are Confederate monuments, and they've been here. The thing about why we're talking about this at all right now is because, you know, this had long been a regional debate. There had long been regional arguments about these statues, but in 2015, after the Charleston massacre, it became a national debate. It moved out of the South, and with Charlottesville, and then of course last summer, it's become part of the national conversation.
Right. And it's really interesting. I interviewed another author here recently called Chester Johnson, who's a white gentleman from the South whose father was involved in the Elaine massacre. Mm-hmm. And Chester has been grappling with how could his wonderful grandfather, who he loves so much, do something so evil. And he wrote a book called Damaged Heritage about it. And when I asked him why he thinks racism is so persistent, and particularly in the South, but obviously it's everywhere. And he actually said, it's the excessive veneration of our ancestors and our tradition about Southern culture. The fact that this whole tradition of honoring the Confederate, and you mentioned this, like these annual events, Confederate Memorial Day, bringing the young children there at a very impressionable age, teaching them the Lost Cause narrative, which is a whole mythologized view of the South in the Civil War, saying it's about states' rights and it's about Southern pride and heritage. No, the war was fought about slavery. And I just found it interesting, this gentleman who's very aware now of race and from the South, steeped in it, is pointing to this cultural piece that you have identified that's expressed in these Confederate monuments.
Well, there's already, immediately, after the Civil War, first, the fact that they owned, whites owned slaves, lets you know that, it begins, the founding of our nation. We've said it was okay for, slaves to be counted as 3/5 of a person for, congressional, legislative apportionment. And immediately after the war, there's this concern. And one of the things that happens is that even if there might be class differences between among whites, among wealthy whites and poor whites, they bring poor, influential men in the region will bring poor whites along with them over the issue of race.
Mm-hmm.
But at the least that, you're the color of your skin, is makes you a better man. And so there's that at play, even without the veneration. But it all works together.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And this whole systematic lost cause narrative that mythologizes the South and the Civil War, I find it very interesting that the people who are behind it even now are huge Robert E. Lee fans. They think he's like the pinnacle of what a man should be. And yet you mentioned in your book, Robert E. Lee was against these monuments. So yes. can you tell us a little bit about what did Robert E. Lee think about these monuments and why?
Right. So essentially he said, if women want to place a little, a memorial in a Confederate cemetery, that's okay. But I don't think, that building monuments is good for healing the country's wounds. In this immediate, I think there are other things that he felt like deserved attention other than, monuments. But here's the thing. He died in 1870, 5 years after the Civil War ended. And the Lost Cause was bigger than Robert E. Lee. He's their venerated leader. He is their, he's the Teflon hero of the South. He's romanticized. There's an entire, what we call a cult of Robert E. Lee, that emerges, and he becomes sort of this, a symbol of white masculinity and white manhood that's unassailable. And it's stripped of that narrative of slavery is completely gone. It's erased from that. Ideas of, of defeat, that's also erased from that, because again, it's still a just cause in their mind. It's still a sacred cause. And he is the ultimate of, Southern leader, Southern representative of manhood. So it's not just about Lee himself, but it's about all former Confederate veterans.
Right, exactly. And of course, the Blacks in the South see all this happening and they know what these monuments represent, and over time get in a stronger position to be able to challenge it. But you quote one of the Southern Blacks saying, "When I see these monuments, it makes me feel like Dixie never fell."
Yeah.
And there have been repeated efforts to remove the monuments over time, challenges many times, but particularly when the Black soldiers returned from fighting World War II. They're over in Europe and Japan fighting democracy and then come home and go, "We want democracy here at home too." And again, in the civil rights era in 1960, particularly with the drive for voting rights. So talk a little bit about the effort to remove these monuments.
Well, I think, first of all, they're always being critiqued. Let me say that. They're not really, the Black community in the South is not in a position to fight about removing the monuments. If they come out and say something like that, they're likely to be lynched. So what they do very much critique these symbols. And so what happens though is, you know, following the civil rights movement and the Voting Rights Act changes everything. Mm-hmm. So for the first time since Reconstruction, they can elect Black officials. And so you see, you know, especially beginning in the 1970s, you know, some of the first Black officials elected to city councils, they are the people who start to question, why are these monuments on the grounds of government, with government, you know, basically taxpayer money used to maintain them? Mm-hmm. This is not representative of the community. And so I write about in the book about Harvey Gantt, who became our first Black mayor in Charlotte, and went on to, you know, challenge Jesse Helms for the U.S. Senate seat. But he, as a city councilman, he was one of that first generation and said, hey, why are we about to put a monument on the grounds of the city hall in 1977, for goodness sakes?
Right.
And he speaks very eloquently about it. And he speaks really, and he's very historically minded, and he understands the real history, and that the war was about slavery, and that had the Confederates won, his ancestors would have remained enslaved. And he's part of that longer tradition, but now he's in a position where his voice really means something. He's a member of the city council. And so that's what you begin to see that. And then you begin to have a lot of discussions, local discussions, in the 1980s. And again, you know, as that progress happens, there's a little real fear among Southern whites. And you see in the 1990s, the emergence of neo-Confederate organizations, specifically the League of the South in 1994. And you begin to see the first hints of gerrymandering in the South.
Mm-hmm.
They barely get, you know, their foot out the door on this, you know, with the vote and there's already efforts within, you know, 25 years to start to try to like dial that back. Every time it's like, you know, two steps forward, you know, it's almost like three back. I mean, right now we're seeing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why, you know, it's Confederate monuments sort of fit into this narrative. Again, even today, there's been the slightest bit of racial progress. You get the 2013, you got the Voting Rights Act. And so monuments fit in there because because if you cannot elect officials that represent your point of view on any number of issues, including Confederate monuments, then those statues are going to stay in place. And they've passed laws to do that.
Right, exactly. And it's fascinating to see in your book, it's like the monuments are the symbol around which a lot of the ebb and flow of the fight for racial justice has taken place in our country. And you talked about the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and I think it was 1965, very significant. And then people, whites and Blacks, going around to register Blacks in the South and build up them at the risk of their lives. And some of those people were murdered for doing that. But to because the whites understood that the power when Black people get the right to vote and they actually exercise it, things mm-hmm. could start to change. And actually, they did change. So you talk about Harvey Gantt, a Black city councilor in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then more city councilors elected. Mm-hmm. Selma, Alabama, became a majority Black council. So it actually took another 20 years after the Voting Rights Act, with all this effort to register people to vote and get people to vote, that then some of these challenges surface to the NAACP in 1987, directly challenging the Confederate flag, calling it for it to be removed from the state houses in South Carolina and Alabama. And get it off the state flags of Georgia and Mississippi. What has happened with that, by the way? Are those Confederate flags still flying there? Are they off the state flags?
I think all of the flags, Mississippi's was the last to go, and it just went last year. They had a redesign of the flag, and so so they're all gone now. Although, at the same time this year, the governor of Mississippi declares April Confederate Heritage Month. So,
wow.
Yeah, one step forward, two steps back. But those flags have been changed.
So that's good progress. And we have seen some of these monuments removed. Now I know we had 800 of them, mm-hmm. Initially, but I was surprised to learn the first time a monument was actually removed from public property was it 1987 in Shreveport, Louisiana?
Well, no, it was the first time it was even suggested.
Yeah, right? Put on the table.
Right, it was the first time it was put on the table. But what's interesting is I know why that people think, oh, it was New Orleans, you know, after Mitch Landrieu
made
his speech and all of that. But the first municipality to remove a monument from government property was Selma, Alabama. And that was because they had a black majority council and a black mayor. And they said, you either move it or we'll move it for you, you know? And so, and that's why it ended up in the cemetery. It's interesting, but that was in 2000. So you see, they were putting up a monument to Nathan Bedford Forrest, who became the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. In the town of Selma. I mean, they were, of course that was protested, but fortunately, you know, the city government actually did something about it. But now there are people back, who are in on that city council now who wouldn't have done that, who wouldn't have made that happen.
But that speaks to the power of vote, the right to vote, and of running for office and getting good people into office. Selma, Alabama was the first town to officially remove a Confederate statue, and that was in the year 2000.
Yes, they removed it from government property, right?
Right.
So that was the thing. The thing people think, oh my gosh, we can't move these things because of our heritage, et cetera. They've been moved a lot. I mean, this is a thing. It's like next in a county adjacent to where I live, when they built a new courthouse, they moved the Confederate monument and put it in front of the new courthouse in the 1990s. Many of these were built before people had automobiles and they began to be traffic hazards. And so they were moved again. So it's not that these things can't be moved. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean just because you remove a monument doesn't mean they're going to be destroyed. There's some options for where they can end up. And in a number of cases, you know, the UDC, the daughters that put them there, have taken them back or they've been moved to cemeteries. There's a variety of things that could happen. So, but wanting to keep them in place on the grounds of courthouse or at state capitals is why they're problematic. And there are efforts, you know, to do that in spite. And so they're going to be you're beginning to see now are legal challenges to these state laws that protect monuments.
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a minute, because you're thinking here, it should be up to the community to decide what happens with these monuments and the community, the growing sentiment to remove them. It doesn't speak to the New South and positive racial relations. And as that movement gains momentum, then the states pass laws that prohibit the communities from removing the statues on their own town squares. It's like, they make it impossible for the local cities to take it down.
Yeah, this is the thing, which is if people were to know Southern history, you would know that local control is very important in the South and has long been important to the South, mm-hmm. Just in the way that states' rights are important in the context of you know, federal policies, local governments and local control is really important, has been important, but not on issues that, you know, they don't want anything to be changing. So these laws, some have been on the books a long time. South Carolina's had been on, had passed a law in 2000 after the NAACP boycott and said, okay, we're going to remove it from the top of the Capitol, and then we're going to put it on a flagpole out front. But now you can't do anything about it. And so that's why there was issues even after the Charleston massacre. Like, you know, there was a big, they continued to debate whether or not they were going to remove the battle flag. So most of these laws have actually been passed in the last 6 years since the Charleston massacre, including in North Carolina, where I live. Only 1 month after the Charleston massacre, the state legislature passed its monument protection law. They didn't even hesitate. And I think what happened when these GOP dominated legislatures saw that if the battle flag can be removed from the Capitol in South Carolina, of all places, because that's about as Confederate as you can get. Mm-hmm. If you can remove that, then what's coming? What's next? And they figured it would be the monuments, right? And so, mm-hmm. So they passed these things they called Heritage Protection Acts or monument laws, but it's all tied to these Confederate statues.
Right. And so when they pass these laws at the state level, it prohibits the towns or cities from removing them, even if the community decides, yes, we're done with this.
Exactly. You can't do it. And there are communities that want to do it. And so what we're beginning to see is litigation. There's going to be, you know, lawsuits filed to try to get these things removed. And they're trying to, you know, kind of be creative about this. It may not, maybe they don't, you know, go for the law itself, but they might go after a portion of the state constitution that they feel like they have can make that case.
Right. Well, and then the other thing that happens when that legal channel becomes frustrated, people turning to vandalize the monuments and then topple them, just take them down with direct action. So there's been some of that happening.
There has been. And so, again, it's born out of frustration that there is no legal recourse. And what's really concerning, I think, is the passage of the anti-riot law in Florida that was just signed by the governor a few weeks ago. And embedded in that law is a penalty, not only financial penalties, you know, for defacing a monument, but if you were to tear one down, it's a second degree felony. You could go to prison for 15 years. So that's taking this a step further. I wouldn't be surprised if other states followed suit in that they strengthen their monument laws.
So what do you think we can do here? It's like, do we need to have a federal law that preempts all the states and just says your community has the right to remove whatever monument is on its public space?
I don't know. I'm not an attorney, but I think there could be something, you know, it would either have to be something like along those lines. It would have to be, you know, again, we're so gerrymandered that we can't elect the officials to change the law. The reason that there were the monuments were coming down in Virginia is because there was a changing of the guard, and there was a Democratic legislature that changed the law. And as soon as that law changed on July 1, you know, the monuments in Richmond came down, except for the Lee Monument, which is owned by the state, and that's in litigation. But other communities did that, and so I think it's going to end up in litigation. Or, you know, there will continue to be vandalism.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. And
you talk about Virginia, and it's interesting because we're right here in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I had another guest on this show once who was the woman, she was a school teacher who ran as a Democrat in Virginia. And she lost the seat like by one vote. It was actually a tie, and they did a drawing to see who would get the seat. And the Republican, of course, won the drawing. And that one seat meant that the Republicans kept control of the entire House. Therefore, they ran the agenda and the committees and everything because of one vote. So anybody, listeners, please, your vote is really important. She did, by the way, happy ending. She ran again and she won. And the Democrats now control both the House and the Senate in Virginia. And it's like, it's amazing to me, the former Confederate stronghold is now very Democratic. And it's exciting to see the positive changes that they're making there. You talked a little bit about this backlash by, you know, it's like the white backlash against racial progress. And for some reason, some white men feel emasculated by the changing politics and demographics. I don't understand myself how looking for racial equality in any way diminishes you. I guess maybe you can't be the master of a slave or you can't be superior race, but what a heavy burden to carry, and why would you want that anyway? But clearly it's deep anxiety. Do you think there's a way to allay that white male anxiety while respecting racial equality?
I'm going to have to say that that would take me way outside of my lane. And
okay. Just curious. You're in the South.
You know, so. But you, well, I mean, this is not a Southern problem. It's a, yeah. It's a national issue. There is, you know, this movement toward white nationalism, et cetera, is about, basically they see the writing on the wall, the changing demographics of the United States. Is going to, you know, they're not, their fear that they'll be the minority. And they, if they know their history at all, they know how they've treated minorities, and maybe they worry that that's going to be them next. I don't know, you know. But I think about this, you know, I remember Susan Faludi's book, Backlash, that came out in the 90s. And she's already talking about that then, that, you know, there's this feeling of, you know, backlash against racial progress, against feminism, again, and it's anti-immigration, it's anti-LGBTQ, you know, you can name all of these, but basically this is about, you know, maintaining white male patriarchy and white male rule over everyone, not just, you know, on the basis of race, but gender as well.
Right, exactly. And it's interesting, I've been doing a lot of work around this gender equality questions. I came across a great quote from a man recently, and he said, "We men should be very grateful that women are only asking for equality, because if they wanted revenge, we would be done in." And I think there's a little bit of that with the white and black thing. You know, as whites, we should be glad the call is for racial equality, equal treatment under the law, not to get revenge on the incredible damage done physically, spiritually, economically to Blacks over the past 400 years. So I think we should be all happy to be getting on the racial equality bandwagon. And it's just like, as a Christian, I feel like that's the way Jesus would want us all to be treating each other, right? And it amazes me that Christians can also be these white national racists.
They absolutely can, especially evangelicals. But I want to say, though, you know, like it's some of the most recent talks I've given on this issue have been with people of faith. So locally, I've spoken twice to a Presbyterian church here, a very large Presbyterian church in Charlotte. And then a few weeks before, I spoke to the North Carolina Council of Churches. So there are people who see this as a social justice. For them, it is about racial justice, but they see this as an issue in which they, as Christians, should be willing to weigh in on and try to improve.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm delighted to hear that. And we're talking about this big problem now of the resurgence of the white supremacists And they got a big boost under the term of Donald Trump in the White House. You talk about the League of the South, and you had connected with them in your research and just wrote to them and asked about their group. And they're telling you that among their goals is seceding from the United States to form a separate Southern nation led by white men. Can you talk a little bit about the Southern League?
They had to change their name to the League of the South because the Southern League represented a baseball league at one point. And right. So they changed it to the League of the South. They emerged in 1994, and it's kind of interesting. It's also the same year of the when House Republicans reclaimed, the House, or Republicans reclaimed the House in Congress. I was in the middle of doing my dissertation research on the UDC, and I thought, what in is this group? And I just started writing them, and they told me that this is their plan, is to, this would be a good thing, like the South should secede, white men are going to be in control, of this new Southern society, et cetera. I tell you what, I think that, and they have been surpassed by other groups, even more radical than they were and are. I think these white nationalists, they take it beyond where these like groups, former Confederate groups, like the Sons of Confederate Veterans had been. They push and push it even further, to the right. They become more radical. And, I think we've been slowly progressing towards the moment that what we saw in Charlottesville has been, it's like a long time coming, and the former president definitely encouraged that, and even the organizers of the Unite the Right rally said, we couldn't have done this if it hadn't been for Trump. They say so, they're very clear about that. And and so they say they're there because in Charlottesville, because they want to protest the potential removal of the Robert E. Lee Monument in Charlottesville. And most of those people weren't even from the South or, had a Confederate ancestor. That was all about a call to arms among white nationalists, white supremacists in that environment. So, we're in an interesting time where that's concerned, and there's, I think that's still part of the group that that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, that they're exactly. All from the same cloth,
right? And we're seeing now, as the FBI and others are investigating, that a lot of the insurrectionaries who stormed the Capitol and caused so much damage are these white supremacist groups, and they're organized and they're armed. I mean, these are dangerous characters, and it's like they came out of the rocks there when Trump was president and he gave sanction to them, and up they rose. So it's a very concerning time in the United States, that you would think we would have that well behind us, and here it is erupting in a toxic stew right in front of us. But I will say, one of the things I learned in reading your book was not only like how deep this goes, how cultivated this white supremacy is since the Civil War. And but I also learned what we can do about it. And if you don't write an essay about it, I may, because I was so excited reading your book that the solution, to me, you tell us what the solutions are. And I'll give you a couple of examples that say, you can look at what did they do that worked, and what can we do that can unweave that weaving they've done. And number one is education. And that clearly these United Daughters of the Confederacy and others systematically, like, I don't know if brainwashed is the right word, but they certainly trained and educated the young ones to learn how to hate Blacks, how to feel superior to Blacks, to believe in white supremacy, to believe in this false narrative about the Civil War. But we can use that education in another way. And you talk about Harvey Gantt, the Black gentleman who became, you know, on the city council and then mayor and ran for U.S. Senator, that Harvey Gantt said he was told the white version of the Civil War in history when he was in school, but his teacher, at that point it was segregated education, he said, his teacher said, and there's another view on this, and told him about more things along racial equality.
So, I mean, what he saw around him in Charleston, South Carolina, which is where he grew up, was an expression of the lost cause. But what he was learning in his own public school and from, I'm sure, you know, African-American teachers, mm-hmm. that, you know, that this is really the true history of the war. And I do think that there is, I think historical history education is really, really important. I think, you know, but again, we're talking about a narrative that has been perpetuated for 150 years. And we have, you know, today we have politicians will say, oh, well, this war was about states' rights and not slavery. I mean, we do. Mm-hmm. There's a concern, you know, this whole 1776 commission that President Trump started, right, you know, was about, you know, we're going to just learn, you know, basically a sanitized version of American history. They see the power of history. I know the power of history. And so you're starting to see state legislatures across the South start to introduce legislation around how history should be taught. I mean, I think we really got to push back on that. And I, you know, I'm only one woman, but I try to do that mm-hmm. as best I can. And one of the ways I think we reach, you know, younger generations, in addition to, we're going to change the textbooks, which is really what the UDC accomplished, is that we have to reach younger people where they're at. And so whenever I have opportunities to develop projects that will reach that generation, I do. So there's a Vox video that I'm in that was about my book on the United Daughters of the Confederacy that has been seen almost 4 million times.
Wow.
I've had students write me from all over the country. They're working on projects related to this, and they'll start off with saying, I saw you in the Vox video. And then most recently, just a couple months ago, I helped to develop a TED Ed lesson for use in public schools called Debunking the Lost Cause Myth. And so and I also developed some additional materials for teachers to use. So, you know, we have to participate in those sorts of things, be a little more media savvy, I think, and where the students are, you know, a younger generation is. And so, and try to educate them, even if their school system isn't going to like buy into, you know, if they're going to like get textbooks that say, oh, that refer to slaves as servants, you know, and not even really take that seriously, which we've seen in Texas, for example.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm excited to hear about all you're doing on the education front. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and think about what the Germans did after World War II, making sure that the next generation understood how evil the Nazis were, and that all the Germans kind of knew that and like took responsibility for that. I think we need to do a similar thing across the United States to make sure that this myth of the lost cause is blown out of the water, and that the real history of the Civil War and Jim Crow and the Civil Rights Movement, I think it's really important that we tell the truth about it. I love that you've got podcasts and videos to reach people. I think it should be part of the national curriculum on educating, you know, in all the states. So we want to get your material known. I get friends who are teachers. We want to get them to know about that as a resource, because it's a longer haul to change the curriculum, but people can show your videos now so they know. So I think that's, you've laid out our three-pronged program for addressing the situation. One is education, tell the real story, the real history. Number two, pass the national laws that supersede the state laws so we can allow communities to decide for themselves what's to become of these Confederate monuments. And third, make sure people register and vote and run for office and get good people in office. It makes a tremendous difference. I would add something that's not in your book, but that I'm very keen on. We need to prosecute the white supremacists for treasonous behavior, like the January 6th insurrection and other acts. I mean, that this group is saying we want to dump the United States and install a country run by white men. I mean, that should not be allowed in the United States. So we need to really stay on that and prosecute those who are treasonous traitors. So that is all the time we have. Well, Dr. Karen Cox, I love your book. I'm holding it up for those who are watching it. No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments, and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. I appreciate you staying with it for decades and helping to educate me and so many others about the real history of the South and the Civil War.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good luck.
Thank you.